Good evening. Excuse me. It's just this is WEFT Champagne. WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM radio. This is the program where we're at. My name is Ben. I'm live in the studio. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champagne, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. It's pretty cold out there if you're been outside today. Right now it's 21 degrees and it's only going to drop even further. It's going to drop down to 15 late tonight. Tomorrow, it's not looking much better. We're getting down now to freezing, below freezing temperatures. Tomorrow it's going to be tomorrow morning when you wake up around 7, it's 8, it's going to be in the teens, 15, 18 degrees. And then maybe it'll get up to the 20s, upper 20s, tomorrow afternoon. Then it'll dip down. But I think Wednesday, though, it could get up to the 40s. So Wednesday, 40 degrees up in the afternoon, 5 p.m. evening-ish. And let's see. I'll look at the... Just look at a little later in the week at, well, then Thursday it'll be kind of like today, 22 degrees. So this is a kind of a freeze, kind of cold, very cold, cold. And it's not going to stay like this for even the rest of the week. Just a little weather preview there, report there. Got some house cleaning, or as I say, or announcements. There is a brand new way to listen to WEFT. You can listen to, of course, you can listen to us online, like right now here on our 90.1 FM on the radio, or you can stream us online at weft.org. You can listen to us on, but we also have if you have your mobile phone, you can add the new WEFT app. That's right. We have our own app, which is available for both iPhones and Android phones. Just go to the Apple App Store or Google's Play Store and search for WEFT FM. Download the app, and you can listen to WEFT live anytime from anywhere in the world. Plus, you can go back and listen to shows in the archives, discover recent playlists, find community information, make a donation, and even record a message or a request, and you can send it directly to WEFT. It's a whole new way to WEFT, to listen to WEFT. So yeah, that's the new WEFT app. Available for both iPhones and Android phones at the which you can find on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Of course, you can stream us online anytime, anywhere, 24/7 at our website, weft.org, where you can find our playlists, music, and public affairs shows, my shows, radio, theater, all should be available there on our website, weft.org. There will be an annual holiday open house on Wednesday, December 11th at 2102 Windsor Place in Champaign. The annual holiday open house, Wednesday, December 11th, 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. As a listener of WEFT, you know how unique and diverse programming on WEFT is. Everything from jazz, blues, gospel, global music, plus public affairs and talk shows that reflect the communities of Champaign and Urbana. But in order to continue to bring these amazing shows, WEFT needs your financial help. And on Giving Tuesday, it's the perfect opportunity to give. Just go to weft.org and look for the blue Donate Now button. We thank you from your community radio station, weft.org. And if you have an old car, truck, motorcycle, or boat that you would like to get rid of, any condition, and this is the part where I meant, it doesn't have to be a clunker. You can donate any old vehicle to Charitable Adult Rides and Services and designate WEFT to receive the proceeds from your gift. All you need is a clear title. Charitable Adult Rides and Services will pick it up and haul it away with no charge to you. Make arrangements on the website at careasy.com or call 855-500-RIDE. That's 855-500-7433. Of course, remember to tell them that you want WEFT to receive the proceeds. Hope you are keeping warm. Just let you know, and if you or someone you know needs to be able to keep warm, the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission has a number of services available for those who may be struggling. They have a program known as LIHEAP, Low Income Energy Assistance. If you go to their website, ccrpc.org, when you type in go on your phone, Google, type in the URL, ccrpc.org, you should see a pop-up about LIHEAP, Low Income Home Energy Assistance. Then you go out that, and there should be an application. When you click on that, you can choose appointment, fill out all the necessary information, all that stuff. It has all the criteria that asks on the LIHEAP application: households with at least one member age 60 or older, households with at least one person receiving long-term disability. This is all on the CCRPC application for LIHEAP, Low Income Home Energy Assistance. If you go to Home Divisions Community Services, you'll also find that there. Other services that the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission offers are Champaign County Continuum of Service Providers to the Homeless, Developmental Disability Services, Homeless Prevention, Rent Assistance, Homeless Services, HUD Housing Counseling Services, Mobile Home Initiative, Safety, Lighting, Energy Efficiency Program, Senior Services, Transportation Assistance, Weatherization, and a lot more. Again, that's the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, which, again, can be found at their website, ccrpc.org. They do have a phone number. They're located at 1776 East Washington Street in Urbana, Illinois. Their phone number is 217-328-3313. Again, that's the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. Their business hours are 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. Their phone number, 217-328-3313. That's essentially all the in their website again. Last time, ccrpc.org. ccrpc.org. I got my scheduled program that I wanted to play. If you This is the program Breakthrough News, I believe. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I will what you're about to hear, I believe, is Breakthrough News, and then right when near the end of the hour, I will wrap things up and continuing here on WEFT Radio.
Breakthrough.
Welcome to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman. Today, we are going to be discussing the recent ceasefire deal struck between Israel and Lebanon and the war of narratives over what it could mean for Lebanon in the near future. But first, some headlines. On Sunday, outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden announced a, quote, full and unconditional pardon for his son, Hunter Biden, who was facing sentencing for federal gun and tax charges later this month. The pardon signals a reversal of Biden's repeated public promises that he would not pardon Hunter or commute his sentence. Biden justified his decision by claiming that his political opponents in Congress weaponized Hunter's charges to attack his presidency. In a White House statement, Biden said, quote, "No reasonable person who looks at the facts of Hunter's cases can reach any other conclusion than Hunter was singled out only because he is my son, and that is wrong," end quote. The pardon also grants clemency for any potential crimes Hunter may have committed from January 1, 2014 through December 1, 2024, a period that would include Hunter's work with Ukrainian gas company Burisma and other overseas business dealings, which have been a point of controversy for Hunter and was the subject of a congressional deposition during Donald Trump's first presidency. Now to our first story. After a devastating 2 months of war on Lebanon, with a reported death count of 3,700, Israel and Lebanon have agreed to a 60-day ceasefire in a deal brokered by the United States. The deal calls for both sides to end combat operations and withdraw from parts of southern Lebanon under certain timetables. Breakthrough's Rania Kalik sat with Lebanese journalist Heidi Francis on November 27th, not long after the deal was announced, to discuss what the ceasefire means for Lebanon.
Heidi, welcome back to Breakthrough News to Dispatches.
Welcome back yourself to Beirut. You bring the good vibes with you wherever you go, Rania. You brought victory with you this time.
Well, that's one way to look at it. It is good to be back. I am coming to you from Beirut, and it's so good to see you. And I think there's a lot to discuss today, and you're the perfect person to discuss it with. We've had several conversations throughout the last more than year of genocide in Gaza, and then when the war in Lebanon escalated. And, you know, Ghadi, I was talking to you yesterday. I was in Hamra in Beirut when the Israelis, you know, we heard the ceasefire announced that was coming, and the Israelis started threatening areas they hadn't hit before. They threatened Hamra. We were kind of waiting for that hit. It was quite a scary moment, but then eventually we reached this point of a cessation of hostilities, a ceasefire. So I guess before we get into some of the details, I'm curious, you know, as somebody who's been watching, commenting, covering, who's from Lebanon, born and raised here, what are your thoughts as this ceasefire takes hold?
It just brings me more and more affirmations and confirmation that we have always been right in trusting our capacity and our potential and our people and our resilience and our resistance and our country, men and women. It brings me respite to know that the Israelis have been taught a lesson that they cannot have their way wherever they want, even if they had the world with them, even if they were given CPU bunker busters by the United States of America, even if they were protected while committing war crimes, while bombing hospitals, while making up excuses to justify daily bombing of residential buildings in the center of a capital, Beirut, with the mainstream media also justifying and all the drums around, like saying, yes, finish them all. With all that, they couldn't have their way with Lebanon. it is not the first time in our history. It is not the second time in our history. It's the third time in the history of the Lebanese people where they drive back to their southern villages and they prove their point. And I think regardless of how we want to consider it politically, when you are coming from a people that have done that three times already, this is becoming more and more rooted in your collective memory, in your collective identity as Lebanese. So the reason why me, a 1989 born woman in Lebanon, was very sure that this is how it's going to end is because I saw it, I witnessed it with my own eyes in 2006. And when I saw from 2006 till date how much this organization grew, how much their capacities and their know-how in warfare also grew and was tested and experienced in Syria, Iraq, and in the region. And seeing that the first day when the rockets continued to go on and on after the pager attacks, after the assassinations, we knew that this is still the same resistance group that was able to deliver in 2006 and would be able to deliver this time. So in general, I see in the course of history, this is another pin, another nail in the coffin of the Zionist entity and the Zionist project in the region. Some people want faster wins. They want to end it now. This is the drive that keeps peoples and resistance groups going. These people who want to end it now, they are the drive. But in every movement, there's this diplomacy. There are the people who sit down and sign the treaties. There are the people who want to stop and then calculate and then reboot. There are the people of the time and the place, today in history, yesterday. But the cause still goes on. It eats up icons and solo humans or personalities into the whole liberation path. And I think Hezbollah as an organization has lost a lot. It is only realistic to consider that. And it's only logical to count your losses, to be able to count your wins. Hezbollah has lost a lot, but as a resistance group, it comes from a different line of measurement and criteria. While as the Israeli, and you're talking about F-35s fighting people in after infiltration with the AI systems, and that couldn't stop 560 sirens in 3 hours from blowing off and on in Tel Aviv 8 weeks after the trials to invade Lebanon. 8 weeks. And 1 year after bombing and striking the targets of all shapes and types in Lebanon. So this is rooted now. We've seen it in our own eyes. And on the long run, I think all this massacre that they have been committing in Gaza and they spilled in Lebanon as well, all this blood, will breed in enlightenment, in awareness, in a new round, in a new generation of very aware Lebanese young men and women who will take it on to keep on fighting the Zionist project in the region.
And I appreciate that. I kind of want to go through the different aspects of all the players here and what their objectives were, what their intentions were, and what they came out with. So I guess let's start with the Israelis. Can you lay out, you know, well, I guess we all know, I'll remind you of some of them, but you can add more. I mean, the Israelis escalated in Lebanon in September with those pager attacks, then ultimately with this mass bombardment campaign across Lebanon that led to them assassinating Hassan Nasrallah and much of the senior, and in some cases, mid-level military leadership of Hezbollah, and in some cases, destroying some of their, you know, weapons. And they never said it wasn't the same as Gaza. Their intentions or objectives that were stated weren't the same as Gaza, but they wanted to weaken Hezbollah, push Hezbollah past the Latani River so that they could bring their settlers back to the north. And they wanted to basically create this massive buffer zone across the Lebanese border, 5 kilometers in. After the last 2 months, can you tell me, based on what Israel's military objectives were, if they managed to meet any of those objectives? And I think that's a good way of kind of segueing into why you probably, or we probably look at this as a defeat for Israel.
Not only were they incapable of meeting their objectives in terms of the northern areas to make them safer for settlers to come back, they ended up having people displaced from Haifa and other regions. And so it spread out. They even exacerbated the situation. We could always see the Israeli media quoting the mayors and municipalities of all the northern areas. We could go to them and they can tell you how many have been displaced, how tens of thousands of their settlements, what they call homes, have been destroyed or attacked. So in general, this didn't happen. On the other side, when they say Litani River, Litani 5 kilometers, these numbers and shapes, Rania, this was the norm, or this has been what they agreed on after 2006.
Right.
So I don't think anybody. I mean, I would picture the Hezbollah actual fighters that have nothing to do with politics, the people that are in South Lebanon that actually changed the whole plan that Netanyahu had. These crazy, passionate, very well-oriented and disciplined fighters. I don't think they really care who says what. And as long as these villages are their villages, nobody can tell them how to be armed or weaponized when the danger is there. But this agreement had to do with rockets or with heavy weaponry, if you go into the details of the 1701. And in general, rockets can still be delivered from northern Litani. I don't think strategically, with the use of the drones and all kinds of rockets that have emerged during this war, I don't think even if they go back to behind the Litani in the military way, that would change the scales or really the stakes in terms of strategic military deterrence that Hezbollah has in southern Lebanon. And one more thing, about the kilometers, Rania, you know very well, us as journalists, we know exactly how the war of narratives have been going. And you just said it in your introduction. And here, so the narrative that they want to say is that they went to Litani River. So you, as an American journalist, say they really reached the Litani River. I would like to tell you and your listeners and our viewers right now that they got to Tel Nahas. So they got into, I would want all of you to check the map to see where Tel Nahas is. So basically they penetrated 1.2 kilometers from the border. after 1 year of bombing these borders, and after actually putting, like you saw the videos of bombing villages and flattening them. So these areas, after they did that for these areas for around a year and a half from the air and around 8 weeks on the ground with the tanks and artillery and everything, after that, they reached to Tel Nahas. They were able to take footage and to come back horizontally, quote unquote. This is Nasrallah's promise. So they didn't get to Litani River. Okay? You see them, they got to Aita Shab. Why are they bombing and clashing with people in Aita Shab last night if they had got, occupied it? So it's a narrative. They come, we saw them, they're rushing. There's actually a video, there's an actual video of real-time footage, but with someone narrating that has been circulated on social media during the clashes in southern Lebanon, where the soldiers come, they climb to the roof, they take footage of themselves with the flag, and then they climb down the stairs, and then they get bumped and killed at the entrance of that building. So this footage of that flag, Israeli flag in southern Lebanon, for around 20 seconds, these 20 seconds, before they were killed and attacked by Hezbollah, this is exactly what Israelis could do in Lebanon. They could raise their flag for 20 seconds. As for what the politics would give them, what they couldn't take in war, Rania, will not be given to them in politics. Even if you may see that, and I'm talking to you, and I know you're a comrade. We don't like deals that are made in politics because a lot of blood has been spilled. So, I don't want you guys or anyone to think that this politics really would change. things on the ground. You know, whatever they say on whatever they agree, whoever says they're going to do what on the day that danger attacks Lebanon, we have seen these people. We have seen exactly what they're capable of doing. And politics will not be allowed to give away what they have fought with their cut fingers and injured eyes, or maybe they lost their eyes. These pager attack targets, these humans, they will not give away with politics and deals what they fought like that for.
So I want to play devil's advocate here, because there is also, there's a couple different narratives going around. And actually one of them is from the pro-resistance side. There's some people, I just want you to respond to this talking point that I've seen, which were upset that this ceasefire was agreed to, who say it's like a surrender. And there's different reasons people feel that way. I mean, you mentioned this is basically just going back to the status quo of 2006 with a few additional details. And, you know, there's like this monitoring group, which is basically just the U.S. and France, according to the ceasefire agreement, that will be like monitoring whether the Lebanese side abides by essentially what was in 1701 back in 2006, which is to have the Lebanese state and Lebanese army guarantee the dismantling of Hezbollah's weapons infrastructure. And so a lot of people see this new monitoring mechanism as part of what they see as a surrender. So I'm curious if you could speak to that critique that I've seen. I don't agree with it, but I want to get your perspective on that, because it does exist. There are some people who are saying this is not something that should have been agreed to. Like, and you know, it's like, why would Hezbollah do this?
Let's start from one principle that it's always essential for people to comment on all events in life, let alone wars. It's very essential for the dynamic of thought to really evaluate. Because a lot of it has been happening, and what you consider win may not be considered wins by the other. It's okay for them to talk. But whatever anyone considers that does not change facts. Surrender is when you are disarmed. Surrender is when you have changed your vibe or what you want or what your purpose is. Surrender is when you're not in the South, when the Israelis told you I'm bombing. Surrender is when you change who you're credibility is given to. I'm not giving you poetry now. I think there are always these people that are the drive. The actual passion for resistance groups comes from people who do not agree on the whole idea of ceasefire to begin with. They don't even want to normalize the idea that Israel is a thing. It is occupied Palestine. We don't even recognize it as a country in Lebanon. Just FYI for the viewers, in Lebanon, by the book, if you want to act as per the Lebanese law, you're not entitled to share a room or a discussion or a conversation with anyone from that entity, because it is considered the Zionist occupation of Palestine as per the Lebanese law. So you're talking about this society. They're trying to break it into a total different society. Wins and surrenders are not identified by the comments of the people after wars. Surrender will only happen if, God forbid, we normalize. If, God forbid, we give them our land, or they take part of our land. If, God forbid, they disarm the only men in Lebanon that were able to protect it, I mean, without even actually empowering the Lebanese army. So, no, these are not... this is not surrender. And I think even the people who call it surrender know that it's not surrender.
So
it's lowering the bar. It's lowering the bar.
Right. And I think so I also want to ask you to respond to something as well, because I think a lot of people are confused, because a lot of the rhetoric around this ceasefire deal and what we've been hearing from the Americans and often from the Israelis is they want the Lebanese army to basically take on the role of disarming Hezbollah. That's something they've always said. It's not new. But a lot of people are confused why, when it comes to Lebanon, Hezbollah is the one that's fighting and not the Lebanese army when it comes to the Israelis. And I know that's a very simple and easy question for you, but people outside the country are confused
I'm really
by this. Makes sense.
I'm really grateful. This is why it's important. Yeah. I just want to tell you that most of the people that want the Lebanese army to disarm Hezbollah would want the Lebanese army disarmed if they fight the Zionists. Okay? So they try to tell you that they love the Lebanese army and they want the Lebanese army. They're just trying to put oil on fire, or, you know, in terms of exacerbating the domestic tension, the sectarian problems, the idea of militia, anti-state, etc. But the essence of the neo-political status quo in Lebanon is Jaysh Shaab Muqawame, people, army resistance. This has been baptized in Doha after an internal conflict in 2008 in Lebanon. So this is the new status quo, or the new bar under which the governance of Lebanon has been happening. In case anybody wants to change that scale, they will have to maybe reshape it with a lot of tension in the streets. And I want to tell you, Rania, it's neither the army would like to, as much as the Americans tried. I mean, the Americans, as in directly, the American embassy in Beirut, the American ambassador in Beirut, the American administration has always tried to make the Lebanese army a kind of pawn for that in the past few months and years, by giving them some political protection, or by saying that they want to arm the army or whatever. But in general, even that did not succeed in splitting the army from Hezbollah for many reasons. But the basic and the most simple reason is that nobody can take on a fight with Hezbollah inside Lebanon. I mean, the Israelis, backed by the NATO and the US, could not break Hezbollah. Who's going to break them? Samir Jaja?
Sorry, I hope my laugh answers that question.
No, I'm trying to be really very factual here, Yani, you know?
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And I think that when it comes to Hezbollah, what their enemies often forget is that this is not just some group that exists like completely detached from Lebanon. I mean, we saw the same images today of Lebanese people who've been displaced, going back to their villages and their towns the first chance they got. And whose flags were they waving? They were waving Lebanese flags and they were waving Hezbollah flags.
No, and they were not wasting their time. They're putting the volume up and they're bringing down the Israeli flags, and they're saying in very beautiful villager language, we're gonna issi issi nihre. Now we're gonna burn it. Take it, we're gonna burn it. So they're enjoying their time.
Yes. Yes.
This is making up and constituting a new collective memory called victory, called survival, called maintaining your land, called defeating the NATO. This is what the people feel like now. They're very sad and frustrated. We have lost many important people and many precious people, and a lot of our city has been targeted. Yes, but believe it or not, you want it or not, these people that were the targets, they feel victorious, regardless of how you see it from your way and place. Even the people of Gaza see in that a victory for themselves. So I think if you're not really from South Lebanon, on the ground, I prefer that you wait a little bit before you tell us what you feel, because they are the ones who actually fought first row. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That said, you know, I think it's like, we don't want to pretend like there wasn't huge amounts of loss here, right? So there was, like I mentioned in my opening, over 3,700 killed, which is a huge number for Lebanon. I think over 40,000 homes have been destroyed with Israel's U.S. armed.
We don't know about the numbers. We don't know about the numbers.
Well, we know there was a lot of destruction, and a lot more destruction than 2006. And this is
Yes. But because about the numbers, the number 40,000 was really circulated, and then everybody was. So unless it is really an actual, I'm telling journalists now, I'm like taking the chance. If it's not really an actual classification or statistical coming from a municipality, or, and like, don't just throw it, because I know Ali Tfaili on Twitter, who's an actual specialist in that sense and from South Lebanon, when the number 40,000 started to be circulated, he just drew kind of the diagram where he actually put the amount of homes in each and every village in South Lebanon as per the municipalities. and something didn't really add up as the number was being circulated. I'm not saying that it's not big. I'm just saying that in terms of numbers, we have to also take into consideration that there's nothing really official, and there's nothing really factual between, like, with us. But, however, the Israeli media told us about how many tens of thousands of Israeli houses were destroyed as well,
and many were from our side. But that, all that said, you know, there's the argument also, and I want to give you an opportunity to respond to this, because it's not just an argument we hear a lot here in Lebanon from certain sectors. It's the argument that gets the most airtime in Western media from Lebanese people, and that is that all of this damage and all of this destruction, and for what? Like, what did Hezbollah gain? What were they looking to do here? What was their objective? And this was actually, if you look at all the destruction, a massive failure, and gave Israel everything it wanted. And then the other argument you'll hear is, I mean, you know, people are allowed to have their opinions about this, but the argument is what was the point of Hezbollah getting involved on October 8th? It was just going to lead to this. And I know I can see you. I know your thoughts on this, but because that's the perspective that most Western English speakers are subjected to in Western media. I'm curious how you respond to that.
Not only Western, actually many people who like Hezbollah are saying these things, who want Hezbollah to win are actually saying these things. It's only logical to consider that many people consider what happened as a strategic wrong. Many people see that this was a wrong strategic step. Even allies of Hezbollah, political allies, have already voiced that, wrote that, and been tried for that in the domestic Lebanese politics. So it's not unlikely for people to say, what was the use of that? I mean, we have Jibran Basir wrote that in the newspaper, and he was like an ally for Hezbollah. So it's not wrong in general to have this question, or to have any question in politics. But what's wrong is to take the Western narrative as a compass in any shape or form, because basically they are the ones in the plane sending the bunker buster. So whatever they're giving airtime on their media to tell me, I must rethink. That's a good point. You know, I'm quoting the Quran here, though I'm like not Islamist, but it's just a very, very important sentence.
It's a wise word.
If a bad person is bringing you news, at least check it. Okay? Yeah. So,
breakthrough.
Again, that was Rania Kalik speaking with Heidi Francis about the Israel-Lebanon ceasefire deal. We're going to take a quick break here on Breakthrough Radio. We'll be right back. Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news, brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman. We'll continue the show by returning to Rania Kalik's conversation with Lebanese journalist Heidi Francis about the Israel-Lebanon ceasefire and what it means for the country and the region.
When you look at some people's lifestyles, if you tell someone you spend 3 hours in the gym every day, they might think that your goals are just a waste of your time, because you could do whatever you're doing in your gym for 1 hour, 3 times a week, and then you could listen to Mozart another hour in the morning. This is what they think gets you to their goal. But your goal from going to the gym is different. What I'm trying to say is that the organizations, the entities, the identities, the ideologies, they set their targets for themselves, whether in what they do, how they do it, when they do it, when they stop it. What was their target, Hezbollah's target? What was it? And did they get to it or not? It's not what, I'm giving you the example of a very known ally, not what the ally wanted or saw as a win. Because some people see the wins and the losses in terms of economy, and yes, we have lost. Some people see the wins and losses in terms of infrastructure, and yes, we have lost. Some people's scales is a bit different and is a bit strategic and is a bit regional. And in the regional side, we defeated the NATO. We stopped the NATO from eradicating southern towns. They started parading that they wanted to take residential real estate investments in southern Lebanese towns. We saw this. This was what they were parading in the first few weeks of their ground invasion plan on Lebanon. How did they leave today, Bawabat Fatima, crawling, crying, devastated, 80% with problems, insomnia, thousands left Israel indefinitely, hundreds of thousands displaced in occupied Palestine. Look at their army. Look at the problems between their army and their government. Look at the Haredim and how they didn't fight, and but their right, their far right, took the whole Israel to that war. Consider for a moment the Israeli economic losses, the thousands in terms of tourism that they have lost, the millions, the thousands of companies that have been bankrupt. So maybe Hezbollah coming and being bred and helped by the Islamic Republic of Iran, who many seem to say that has played with this and didn't really support. I mean, today Afikhay Adra'i was telling us that Iranians are sending weapons to inside Palestine, if you could see. So people from the Gulf regions that are actually fueling the Israelis are judging the Iranian help to the Palestinians. I mean, you stop supporting Israel and then we'll allow you to judge the Iranians. Yeah. I don't want you to support the Palestinians. Just stop supporting their killing, and then you will have the moral leverage to even give a say. Anyways, so I'd like to say that the Iranians believe in a long war, harb al-istinzaf, what do you call it in English?
You're asking the wrong person. The long war, they live in strategic patience? Is that the thing we're talking about?
No, it's the long-term war. It's the, you know, so So this is what Khomeini's philosophy taught, harb al-istinzaf. They don't want a full-blown war with that entity. They believe that the way to end that entity, which quote-unquote they call the cancer, okay, they believe that it is only fought and ended through patience and wars at the borders in a different in a system that's sometimes it's sometimes really in a high frequency, sometimes in lower frequency. And I think Hezbollah, it's their target is to end Israel. And on the path to end Israel, that's not easy, to burn 60 tanks, to destroy planes, warships, to actually further root their defeat and their inability to do anything in southern Lebanon. I think we are looking and we are witnessing the catalyzation of the end of Israel. And in their long-term targets, yes, they did become one step closer.
So I want to ask you about the issue of, I mean, this is a bit more difficult to talk about because all we can really do is speculate, right? But over the last year, and this is something that people who are, you know, pro-resistance are even asking is, okay, you know, there was a lot of times where we would hear from Hezbollah leaders that if Israel did this, if Israel crossed a certain red line, they would respond with, you know, like civilian for civilian, right? Or Dahiye for Tel Aviv, like if they hit Dahiye, we'll hit Tel Aviv. And what we saw over the last year is every time that Hezbollah would, you know, create this red line, if this is a red line for us, Israel would cross it. And this actually goes to the Iranians too, because the Iranians did this as well, is every time a red line was crossed, rather than responding how they said they would respond, they would kind of do a soft response, or in some cases with the Iranians, no response at all. And so the sort of like looking back hindsight here is that perhaps not responding as strongly as promised actually ended up emboldening the Israelis ultimately. And then other people are asking, well, where was all this weaponry? Because Hezbollah did manage to hit Israel a lot over the last couple months, but it wasn't to the capacity or frequency that we had expected, or that a lot of people had expected, given what Hezbollah said they were capable of doing. So that's a conversation that's happening right now, was that capability maybe there and attacked when there was that massive attack on Hezbollah's senior leadership and they had to regroup and like rearm? Because that's very possible that's what happened. Or was it never there to begin with? And again, this is just pure speculation, but this is a conversation that's happening. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that particular discussion?
I really don't, you know, I don't understand why everyone has a say in everything and why I should listen to everyone's say in everything in general.
Point.
But I will, really, I mean, so they are, because your question is not starting with like logic says they are saying. And in general, what they are saying is a part of the whole narrative because they are starting to say in the Western media, and then we're in the same vicious cycle. Let's talk a little bit about.
But it's important to address these things because this is the conversation that's happening. This is what people.
Yeah.
This is how
I choose to answer about that. I choose to start with the person listening to me by telling them that this narrative has been put in their brain. So I like to start dismantling it like that. I'm not saying we shouldn't ask. We must talk about it every day because it's everywhere on the other side. I just want to say, like, to revisit where we were in the previous point, people who support Israel cannot judge Iran about how they respond. And I think I was saying that with many platforms in the beginning, after Ismail Haniyeh assassination. We were all saying it, we were all repeating it, that Benjamin Netanyahu's best case scenario is that everyone has a fight with Iran, right? I think I'm trying to be Iran here, not in the defense. I would love for Iran to do all they can to end things right now.
We all would mind that.
But first of all, it's a state. So non-state actors can fight Israel in a more free way for reasons that they cannot be in the same situations, and it doesn't put into diplomacy and world diplomacy in the same way. And this is their problem with Iran by empowering non-state actors in the region, because they bought the states, they dismantled the actual states that were against them. They took wars on Syria, they invaded Iraq, they took it in differently in Lebanon. So then non-state actors continued to fight Israel. This is why their problem with Iran is helping these non-state actors. And if Iran stops supporting Hamas and Hezbollah today, tomorrow they have a deal, they don't mind. They don't mind. Their problem with Iran is exactly about Israel. It's not about something else. They have been dealing in oil and gas and nuclear technology in different ways throughout their histories. Their problem is the regional alignment. But let me tell you something. I think, yes, had Iran striked harder, maybe they wouldn't be empowered to continue and to assassinate. I do share that idea. But I also think that if we take into consideration how speedy and hungry Netanyahu was to make it, to turn it into a fight with Iran, I think it was really tricky for them to be able to control that shark that wants to bite you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Shark is a good word in that sense. Okay,
yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
to control them from exacerbating that issue and like empowering them, but in the same way, in the same time, not to give them any justification to bring in the NATO warships and to bring it on and to make it all about Iran and to forget that this war criminal has massacred more than 40,000 humans in 1 year. So I think when you're looking at, this is only thinking with you, when you're looking about it, I'm a nation, I'm a region, I'm an alliance, I'm an axis. I don't think it's really about how we feel about their performance. It's about maintaining their ground, their plants, their access. I mean, the Iranians are there when the 60% of the world trade is being attacked or threatened in Yemen. The Iranians are there.
Yeah.
When the Iraqi groups are attacking American bases in Iraq or NATO places in Iraq, the Iranians are there. It's not without Iran that these groups are doing that in the larger circumference of the region. I see it like that. I see it like that. If like trying to, in general, these ideas are very essential to build and to evaluate on the wrongs. If we really do believe, as peoples and cultures and states and non-states and ideologies, if we really do believe in our target in liberation, all of these should be really spoken about, dismantled like you are doing right now, corrected.
Yeah,
we have to learn from something at some point, you know? It's not like we're always right, Yani.
And I think it's also important to recognize, like, I mean, I struggle with this too a little bit, but I think it's important to recognize that, like, Israel is a really well-armed state. It's the most well-armed. Like, you always mentioned this, Ghadi. There's, like, billions and billions of dollars worth of weapons constantly flowing to Israel from the US, from other European states to destroy this region. And it's really hard to go up against that. And the fact that, and I don't want to like say, oh, like Hezbollah is like the most strongest, powerful organization in the world, but they are up against something that has significantly more weaponry. And they did have to deal with a huge setback a couple months ago. And they came out of it quite resiliently. Like, I think we were all quite impressed with how they were able to perform in the south.
It was a war to end them.
Yeah, that's, you're right. Setback is not strong.
It's even big. Yeah. Even the word setback is not strong enough, because if you look at even states or armies, I'm talking about groups. I mean, do you remember a few years ago when there was like a 10-minute coup against Erdogan and he ran with like one sock to the airport?
Yeah.
Do you remember? I remember he was on Skype and we had that joke in the family group, like he had only one sock on because he was in a hurry to leave the home and to leave Istanbul and to leave the country and to leave Ankara.
One sock.
They didn't have time for to wear two socks, you know, Northern Lebanon jokes. So that was Turkey, one of the biggest armies in the world, you know, and the system of Turkey, I mean, the Islamic Brotherhood, the Neo-Turkey, Erdogan was about to crumble in 10 minutes because something happened. So you're talking about an organization, a bunch of Lebanese underground, you know, like outlaws who don't want to sell and deal in politics. They just want to protect their land. And these were able to manufacture all that, to do all that, to change the course of all that, and to actually tell the world that even if you kill our leader, even if you target hundreds of, containers for our rockets, our weapons, even if you infiltrate our systems, our homes, our ACs, our phones, our pagers, even if you use the world's billion-dollar funded propaganda machine to justify bombing each and every doctor from our society, hospital, bank, anything, even if you do all that, nobody rushed with one sock to go anywhere. They remained there, steadfast, defending their land. This is, I think this is where everything stops. This is where you stop evaluating, because the human, Rania, the human is the actual element that brings the weapon. The human brain, the human will, the human idea is the actual place where the whole ideology, you cannot kill that idea. Once that idea was even empowered and rooted more, these new people will deliver new weapons, they will deliver new systems, they will make up new intelligence, spyware that will protect them from more similar intelligence infiltrations from the Israelis. And just I'm quoting now Al Akhbar newspaper. Yesterday they had a video about how there was a rocket that they fired at Lebanon in 2006, and then we took that technology as Lebanese and we manufactured something from it to even like switch the effect. So I think in the course of the long-term war to liberation, our people and our organizations and our brains and our engineers will learn from that loss. We'll learn to correct these wrongs.
So, okay, another thing that I see people, I know we shouldn't care so much about comments, but I see people saying
this. We should.
No, saying is, and I want to give you a chance to address this, but I also think Hamas also just addressed it. But one of the criticisms was that, okay, so like Hezbollah entered this war October 8th to basically in solidarity with Gaza against the genocide in Gaza, that we shouldn't also forget that Hezbollah entered knowing that Israel was planning to attack Lebanon. So to try and delay that, which I think they did manage to delay that for quite some time. The point is that the big sticking point was we refused to decouple from Gaza. So we won't stop firing at the Israelis until they stop their genocide in Gaza. So one thing the Israelis are like kind of taking a victory lap over is the idea that, well, we got them to decouple from Gaza. But actually, before I ask you to respond to that, I want to read this. You know, Hamas released a statement about the ceasefire in Lebanon. And in part of it, they said, the Israeli enemy's acceptance of the agreement with Lebanon without meeting the conditions it had set marks an important step in breaking Netanyahu's illusions of reshaping the Middle East through force and his misguided belief in defeating or disarming resistance forces. So that's coming from Hamas, who Hezbollah was acting in solidarity with.
I'm going to have to end that there. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker, who do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign Prairie Air Incorporated. Station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. I'm going to play out now with some Beethoven. I don't think I've ever played any Beethoven. From A Composer's Christmas, Ride Biker, Deck the Halls Fantasy. But that's that. Please keep listening to us here on WEFT Radio. Now, have a good night.